I'm terribly sorry for being a little late. I should not. Here is where we are. We are maybe a little bit behind. We are supposed to start talking about the discovery of causality from data. And we have still four classes, including the one today. So what I will do is I will start with, I will finish problems in the laboratory, and then we'll continue with discovery of causality from data. I guess we can probably reasonably catch up and be reasonably on time. If worse comes to worse, computation-intensive methods, is another way of testing hypotheses, and I think this is one thing that we can easily skip if needed. Let me check presence. That will take just a moment. I think you are all there. 3, 6, 9, 10 minus one, that's nine.
Alina Taiwani of College.
I'm sorry.
Probably not group.
Oops, sorry, this is not the one. I'm sorry. I should have been better prepared. Here it is. Nine. One person is not here. Maybe I should read. Mehmet is here. Opavo is here. I didn't see who you. Usually you are there. Ms. Boruchinska? Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Svalina. Ms. Kowalczuk? That's her. She is not the one. She's the one who is not here. The rest of you are there. Okay, great. Let me first continue with the problems in the laboratory. I remember the place where we started, but I'll start from the beginning and really rush through it. It will just take a moment. So if you remember, we talked about problems in the laboratory, and we focused on several things. First thing was our senses. Our senses which are imperfect and I essentially showed you a lot of things. This thing was important in showing that vision happens at somewhere at a higher level. I think all of our senses are processed at a very high level in the brain. Well, that means that to the things that we see, hear, touch, or smell, or taste, there is our experience added. And that means that we can actually disregard things, or we can add things to the stimuli that we see, and that's very worrying, isn't it? Memory, for example, that's not in the slides. Memory is funny because we can forget things, you know. You all know that we can forget things, but we can also generate things. We can generate things that never happened. Did you know about that? When I heard it, it was surprising to me. We can. Yes, and we can, I know we can create things, you know, some even events that we think we were there, but they actually never happened. Very interesting. So this was the first idea, I think, very important, this higher level of processing, which makes the senses not very reliable. Then I showed you a lot of pictures showing essentially the effect of that, seeing circles where they are not there, seeing dots that are not there. When you start focusing on any of the crossing, you see that there is nothing there, but we tend to see dots. We tend to see dots here, and I think there are no dots at all, actually, in the middle. And then remember the the colors. This was taken with paint, so you see when they are next to each other, they are the same color. I don't know if you try to repeat it or not, but I was surprised. And we are fooled by the shadow. When we see a shadow, things are usually lighter than we see, so we actually make that B lighter than it really is in our brain. These were similar things. Then the motions showing the things that are happening. If you look long enough, violet circles disappear. So a lot of things that are in context, the surroundings make things, we perceive things bigger or smaller. Motion with very confusing things. We think like it's like a spiral. Colors, the judgment of length influenced by the context, by the surroundings. Here we see a circle that's not there. Then here we have difficulty with counting the dots. There are dots, there are 12 dots, but we see many more, and they disappear when we look at different things. Here I didn't see those digits, but maybe you can see it. On the screen, I remember I did see them. Things like that, a lot of things. The delay, the hysteresis, when we look at it long enough and then look at the white background, we see a skull. Then the interpretation of the picture, a skull or a lady in front of a mirror, an Eskimo or a face of an Indian or an Eskimo, old lady, young lady, the same idea here, Einstein or Marilyn Monroe, depending on how we look, a face of a young woman or birds. This is actually, the children usually see birds. Here the children usually see dolphins because they are not used to seeing naked bodies, and adults usually see easily a couple embracing, naked couple embracing. So our experiences. Then this is kind of funny, the same thing in four pictures, as you see, depending on how it's turned, we perceive this as kind of concave or convex, and probably because most of the time the light comes from the top, we see that the bottom one, the middle one, is concave. Here, the other way, because again, light usually comes from the ceiling, and we are influenced by that. So these are a lot of things. Faces, we recognize a face to be female or male depending on the contrast. This is the same picture, but digitally processed to highlight the contrast on the left side, and we perceive this as a female face, and on the right-hand side as male face with less contrast. We see the right, the negative. These are the same pictures, of course, but in positive and negative. We feel as if the guy on the right is looking at us because we are sensitive to the dark pupils in our eyes. And then, of course, the influence of age. Hearing also imperfect. It's not linear at all. There's a range of frequencies that we hear, and depending on the frequency, we hear better things in a certain range. Probably we are optimized for the range of speech, because we talk a lot with other humans and we hear other humans. Maybe dangers also, things outside of the range are less important. We need stronger stimulus to hear them. And we measure it actually using also psychological metrics, not physical. In psychological metrics, things are a little bit different than they are in physical ranges. This is the range of hearing and different types of noises, speech, music, and the whole range of that we can hear. We are probably optimized for the middle, for the speech. Hearing is imperfect. And then we talked about selection of subjects and stimuli. The important things here were that we need to select a sample from the population. And we talk a lot about humans, because a lot of things are happening when you do experiments with humans. But remember, the same things are happening with data when you are a computer scientist and want to analyze data sets, do learning. The same things happen when you are trying to find out the best mixture of a concrete, buildings, constructions, bridges, the same thing. You need to select a group, a sample from the population. And the sample is very, very important because the conclusions are going to be valid for the sample, and you can generalize it only if the sample is representative to the population that the sample represents. And then, in this context, we did a lot of things, well, some things. I quoted one example, kind of well-known example in this context, of an election poll that selected a sample that was not representative of the population of the United States. And they called people, and phone was an object of, it was a luxury object, usually rich, conservative people. When people are rich, they are conservative. When they are older, they can afford a phone. They want a phone. When they are older, they are conservative. Common cause, those who had phones tended to vote more Republican. And the prediction of the results was very wrong, very wrong. Then I told you about this study where they relied on volunteers they had a questionnaire for them, asked them questions about their sexual lives. They rely on volunteers, and volunteers are, of course, special. They are typically different than, well, any way you select a sample using not random criteria, the criteria of selection criteria may make the sample different. It depends on what you're doing with that. If you are studying sexual lives, I think volunteering is a very, very important aspect of that correlates with the actual behavior, sexual behavior, and the likelihood of volunteering. If you are studying, for example, memory, or you are studying something that has to do with human cognition, I don't think volunteers are very different, except for the thing that I mentioned, that they may have a slightly higher IQ than the population, but otherwise they are okay. So when you are, depending on what study you are doing, volunteering bias may be stronger or weaker. In those topics where people, where the subject actually influences whether you volunteer or not, the bias can be very, very strong. Another bias is non-response bias, and I think this is around the place where we stopped last week. When you approach people and ask them, would you please take part in a study, when you do it by mail, a heuristic response rate that is pretty much across the fields is around 5%. Around 5% of the people decide to respond. 95% just ignore it. If you can increase that, that response rate, the result of the study is going to be much more reliable. And you can do it in many ways. You can make people feel guilty. You can pretend to be a big person, professor, doctor, habilitowany, etc., etc. That makes it maybe more likely for people to respond. You play on their feeling of guilt or feeling of patriotism or whatever you can to do it. It's a good idea. So then the next slide, I think I may have flashed it or... I think this is where we stop. So there was a study. Remember, the Kinsey study happened in 1960s. In 1980s, there was a study done by University of Chicago that wanted to replicate those results. Those results were, I would say, scandalous. Completely, people were so surprised. If you remember, the numbers were just absurd. Like 50% of the people are unfaithful to their husbands and wives, a few percent had sex with animals, and 20% have had homosexual experiences, sadomasochism, and all kinds of things that are just hard to believe. In science, in general, when you produce something that is difficult to believe, immediately somebody else, somewhere in the world, will try to replicate it. Because that's an opportunity. You publish something hard to believe, people immediately want to check if it's true. So in many controversial results, I've seen it actually happen. There's a whole line of study, for example, of human judgment under uncertainty. That's closer to my area of research. Human judgment under uncertainty. There are experiments that are infuriating. People are violating basic laws of logic and set theory. Here's an example. They give you a... they ask you to respond which of the following is more likely. They tell a story about a woman, Linda, who is... she was very active in the feminist movement when she was young. She studied social sciences. She took part in demonstrations for animal rights, for disarmament, you know, all kinds of social issues. And then you are asked to judge, to rank order the following events. Linda, that's the lady, is a bank teller, working at the window serving people in the bank. Generally a very boring job. It's hard to believe that Linda could ever end up being a bank teller. Linda is a feminist. Linda is a feminist bank teller. They judged this to be the most of the subjects, I think like 70 or 80%, judged this to be most likely, given the description. Of course, she was fighting for animal rights, for all kinds of socially progressive issues. This was the second, this was the third. And that's obviously a violation of fundamental rules of logic. If this is being a feminist, this is being bank teller, this is being a feminist bank teller, it cannot possibly be that being feminist bank teller is more likely than being a bank teller. Right? You can see that. No matter how unlikely it is that she's a bank teller, maybe it should be something like, let me change this a little bit. Something like this. Still, being a feminist bank teller is less likely than being a bank teller. Or maybe given the description that was given earlier, the probability that she's a bank teller is very small, right? But being a feminist bank teller is still smaller. So that is absolutely wrong. So the first experiments like this happened, I think, in 1970s, and of course, maybe 60s even, 60s, 70s, you might have heard the name Kahneman and his colleague Tversky. He got Nobel Prize around 2010, I think, in economics, even though he was, he definitely worked in psychology for a long time. And I don't know what his background was, maybe statistics. In any case, he was moving between disciplines very hard in Poland now. But don't worry, it's going to change for sure. It's a matter of time. In any case, and he wrote us a very nice book after getting the Nobel Prize. The English title is Thinking Fast and Slow. I definitely advise you to read that book just for the basic thinking skills. Anyway, look at that result. People are stupid. In fact, they had several other experiments showing how stupid people are. Of course, whoever reads that thinks, no, I'm not that stupid. The people I know are not that stupid. And they try to replicate it. And they replicate it in many places in the world, this experiment and many similar experiments. The frustrating thing was that they got the same results. So indeed, That is happening. We are imperfect in our judgments. This whole story, taking a step sideways to the side, is to make you aware that if you produce results that are surprising, very important, surprising, new, you can be sure that somebody working in your field is going to try to replicate them. I gave you already that example. In early 1990s, there was a big ado about cold fusion. They submitted a paper claiming that they observed cold fusion in room temperature. Incredibly, incredibly important result. Science, one of the journals that are really, if you have a paper there, one paper, usually people will know how to spell your name. Science and Nature, these are the two really very, very important journals. In the ministry, the score, if top journals have whatever, 200, science should have like 1,000. I think the effort, it's very difficult to get there, really breakthrough work. In any case, they submitted a paper to science. The paper got rejected because they wanted more details. The reviewers asked for more details. But at the same time, they gave some interviews to press, and immediately, in several places in the world, they tried to replicate the experiment. They couldn't. It turned out, in the end, that they had some impurities in the lab, in the experiment, that caused more energy than they put in. So in any case, that study was famous, and infuriating. People were just thinking, well, that doesn't make any sense. So the University of Chicago guys replicated it, but they did not rely on volunteers because, of course, they realized that the results were because of the volunteer bias. So what they did is they took a sample of Americans. I forgot how big the sample was, but I think it was a few thousand people. So they sent them letters. That was 1980s, no internet, etc. They sent them letters. And of course, 5% of them responded, okay, I'll do it. Given that you are paying whatever they were paying, $20 or $100 to participate, yeah, we'll do it. 5%. Then we have non-response bias. Who responded? Of course, people who don't mind talking about their sexual lives. Who did not respond? Well, people who were too lazy, they didn't want to do it, $100 was not enough, or people who just did not want to talk about their sexual lives. So what did they do? They sent another mailing, and another. They started calling people. Some of the people, they approached 14 times, that's what they report in the things, 14 times saying, would you please respond? Why didn't they just pick somebody else? Well, those people were in the sample. They wanted to do it right. They were sampled, they were chosen, they wanted those people. So 14 times, playing on all kinds of things, feeling the guilt. Maybe they called, they even knocked on their door. How did they know who they are? How do they select people in a study like this? At that time, there were telephone books. You probably not know what they are. Oh, you do. you are old enough to know what telephone books are. So there were companies that created reverse telephone books. How do you do it? Well, telephone books, as you know, they are ordered by the last name, first name, and then they also reported the address and the phone number. So what they did is they scanned them in a computer, and they produced books by address. Wonderful, isn't it? Then you can see, okay, let me see who lives at Wiejska Street. What are their names and phone numbers? Dangerous, isn't it? But it's open data. They could do it. So once they had the reverse telephone books, they could sell random samples of Americans because they could easily just draw those samples in such a way that the people selected are evenly distributed in the whole country. So the sample is good. 14 times. So they really made sure that they approached everybody. And still, there were 20% of the people who said, no way, we are not going to do it. Of course, that means a bias. Because who were they who did not respond? Maybe there were people like Donald Trump. And 1 minute of my time is worth $20,000. I'm not going to do it for $100, right? They have no time. But among the 20%, there were also people who were very shy, who did not want to talk about this topic. So still there is bias. But with 80%, the bias is definitely less. So what were the results? I don't think you have seen it. 75% of the men and 85% of the women are faithful to their spouses. Compare that to 50%. Only 3% of all women had more than three partners in the last year. Most satisfied people were in... So they ask, of course, are you satisfied with your sexual life? Most of those who were satisfied were in monogamous relationships. Just one partner. 2.8% of the men and 1.5% of the women identified themselves as homosexual, which is close to what we know about homosexuality. I was, when that study came out, I remember an article in Time or Newsweek, one of the two. They used to be good magazines. They are no longer good. I stopped reading them years ago. They reached the level of the street, I think. But at that time, they were good, especially if you lived in Poland, that was communist. You could read Newsweek and Time if you went to the reading room of the American embassy, or there was also Empik. Empik used to have reading rooms, even during the communist Poland. You could go there and read some of those Western magazines. In any case, I remember reading an article in 1980s. I was already in the Netherlands. I was out of Poland at that time. The article reported the data, but also I remember asked Hugh Hefner for comments. You know who Hugh Hefner is? Some of you may know it. Hugh Hefner was the guy who created Playboy. Playboy is one of those kind of soft porn, I would say, not pornographic, but kind of, you know, a magazine that for people who are liberated, I would say, kind of jokingly. So there was an interview with Hugh Hefner. Hugh Hefner was famous for showing up at parties always in a nightgown. He wanted to be ready, you know, just take it out quickly when needed, right? So there was a picture of Hugh Hefner, of course, in a nightgown. And he was saying something like, yeah, that's what I've been telling you. People don't pay enough attention to fun things like sex. that was funny. So in any case, 20 years later, you could expect people to become more liberated. 20 years later, so the results are probably less conservative than they would be in 1960s. But they are so, so much different. You can see how strong those biases are. I may have mentioned to you in this context that when you do an experiment with concrete, order it from different places, for example, so that you avoid one batch because there may be an error in the production in that batch. So try to diversify. Try to make it representative anyway. Whatever you're doing, try to do this differently. So whatever you can do to increase the compliance rate, the response, of course, if it's not perfect, it will not eliminate the bias, but hopefully it will reduce it. The next thing is subject experimenter effects. And we did talk about it a little bit. The slides are a little bit boring, maybe. The experimenter is the measuring instrument, which is a problem because the measuring instrument is not perfect, it's biased. So, and subjects have also a preconceived notion of expectation. So they, they can be different things happening. Artifacts are factors that may put the results in danger, in question. Subject experimenter artifacts are those things that are happening between the subjects and experimenter. If they are unintentional, because of course they can be intentional. In science, people can perform intentional things, essentially be dishonest. And there have been examples of that, of dishonesty in science. And that, of course, I think things like that happen less in science than elsewhere. My feeling is that there are more dishonest people outside of science than they are inside of science. Why is that? I think the reward for being dishonest is less. You don't get more money. You get a little bit more money because if you are dishonest, publish a few papers, maybe you are more likely to get grants. But that's short-sighted because if you are dishonest, probably you are producing some very kind of surprising, very nice results. Somebody will check it and will question, why am I not getting the same result as that person? So at some point you may actually, they may find evidence that you were cheating. Once you get that, the penalties are high. So rewards are not that big, but the penalties are high. What happens to a person who was dishonest? Forget it ever getting money again, because people, when they know it in the field, the reviewers will point out when they review your grant proposals, it's going to be harder to get your work published, you essentially go down. So the penalty is high, rewards lower, so there are fewer dishonest people. But they still happen. Still dishonest people happen. There are artifacts that happen. For example, subjects, human subjects, want to please the experimenter. They behave almost like a patient at the doctor's office. The patient wants to be really very precise to the doctor. When you answer, I think I talked about it already. Do you get headaches? I normally don't get headaches. But now that the doctor is asking, yeah, last month on a Tuesday, I had a headache, right? You try to be really very, very good. The same happens with people with experiments. They really try to please the experimenter. They want to show how smart they are. They want to do their best. So it's an effect that they call good subject effect. Apprehension effect, we talked about things that happen in the context of there was a list of dangers that can put the results of experiments in question. The external things were, we talked about them, the Hawthorne effect. When people are in an artificial setting, they behave differently. So when they are apprehended, they behave differently, and we have to remember about this. Here's a list of the non-interactional and interactional effects. Non-interactional are observer effects, errors in observation, in interpretation. If there is any dishonesty or sloppiness is also on the border of being of dishonesty. You have to be very careful and systematic when you are doing any measurements, any observations. If you are sloppy, then it's really bordering with dishonesty, scientific dishonesty. Interaction, there are different things, biosocial, age, sex, race, psychological, situational, expectancy. Biosocial, it's, you know, we know there is a difference when you ask age, a man and a woman, let's say in their 30s or 40s. At some point, you know, you don't ask ladies their age, but you can expect less clear answers from ladies than from guys, right? Maybe not, no longer so, but this is an effect of sex, for example. An age. Psychological, of course, personality, temperament, of both the subject and the experimenter, situational, the context, the situation, and expectancy, that happens a lot with experimenters. Experimenters tend to have expectations. When you conduct an experiment, you know, you hope that the results are going to be one way or another. If you don't control yourself, if you don't watch out, you can actually read the results the way you wanted them to be, without actually being dishonest. You really may start making mistakes that are in your favor, in the favor of your hypothesis. Do you know what Clever Hans is? Did I tell you about Clever Hans? The horse who could count? He knew arithmetics. In basic arithmetics, they tested him with adding, dividing, multiplying, and subtracting, say, one-digit numbers. So they would ask, maybe two digits, but not more. They would ask Hans, tell us, in a circus, how much is 12 minus 8? And Hans would do with his hoof, with his front leg. Wow! Hans, 2 times 3. And then he would do it 6 times. The audience was completely ecstatic. Hans could count. Until they wanted to test Hans, scientist, somebody who was doing some logical thinking, wanted to test Hans, and put a paravan, you know, hit Hans from the audience. Hans no longer could see the audience. And what happened? He forgot how to count. He kept beating or did not beat at all. What happened? Hans was observing the audience. As he was approaching the correct number, the audience apparently was looking differently at Hans. And he could sense it. He could feel it. And knew how to count. I told you already about the rats, the maze smart rats. That was also an example of interaction effects. We don't know what exactly happened. Maybe they were the experimenters were treating the rats differently. Maybe they were smiling to them. Maybe they were showing them with their eyes where to go to find the food. We don't know. In any case, the observed times were definitely much, much shorter with the maze smart rats. What can you do? You can increase the number of experimenters. So if one experimenter is doing something not completely right, maybe another experimenter would do it right. So you introduce some defects in different directions. So that may help. Observe the behavior of the subjects and experimenters. Record it. It's so easy today to record everything. You know, you can just use your phone. Used to be difficult, but today is so easy. Look for things that are happening that you observe in several places, the order type of effects, things that are happening more often. Blinding. We talked about this. I think I have a slide on blinding. Minimize the contact. So when you, for example, give instructions, you a trick is to print the instructions, not to read them or to say them. Make them as short as possible. Minimize the contact so that you don't transmit things. Control expectancy. Expectancy control is a thing that can be done not only with humans, animals, but also with artificial, with engineering things. I may have told you already about the guy who was who wanted to conduct experiments that would show the mass of electron. I think I told that story. When he was, when he decalibrated the instrument, because he knew, he kind of roughly knew what the mass was. He had reasons to think the mass was like this. Maybe he conducted pilot studies or something. But what he did is he decalibrated the instrument so that he could take measurements that would where he had no idea which way to go. He conducted the entire experiment, and only at the end he. He modified the results with the decalibration to get the exact value. That way, he avoided computation errors, calculation errors, in his favor, in the favor of his expectation. A placebo, you remember, that's an interaction effect, really, because when you do something to the patient, you cause the patient to get better. So in order to avoid it, you administer placebo, which is something that looks like a medicine, but it doesn't have any effect, any physical effect. Blinding prevents the effects in the interaction between the experimenter and the subjects. the experimenter doesn't know which group the subject belongs to. How can you do it in any type of experiments? Well, you hire somebody not telling what the group is. You avoid contact between the experimenter and the subjects. There's a beautiful quote that I'm not going to read because it will be boring, but the quote is beautiful because it says about this difficulty that all kinds of things that can be happening, all kinds of biases, all kinds of effects. The scientist is working under incredibly difficult conditions. And don't think that you as engineers have it much easier. You have it easier, of course, than scientists working with people, with animals, with living things that are moving around, etc. You have it easier, but still there are many things that can be happening. So you have to be very watchful, very careful. Be very careful, very systematic, and make sure that you are avoiding as many of these things as possible. And if you can't avoid them, then somebody else will replicate your experiment. Every experiment is just one point, and when you have many other points, we can fit a curve to those points and have a theory. In that sense, every experiment is just a single result, single data point. And because of careful people who are watchful, careful, science progresses in the long run. Our senses and reasoning capabilities are limited. We can easily make mistakes and errors. Our knowledge is also limited, always. We need to realize our limitations and possibilities of errors and then try to minimize them. Every experiment is conditioned on this background. So when people replicate, they try to do differently. For example, when they're replicating this experiment, Linda, and bank teller, and feminists, immediately somebody else phrase it differently. Linda is a bank teller, whether she is feminist or not. Linda is a feminist. Linda is a feminist bank teller. So they try to make it clearer. It had some impact on the effect, but not as much as we would like to. People were still making this silly logical mistake. So they changed the wording, they changed the task, they changed the population, they tried young people, they tried educated people, they tried whatever. And these were different points that that were collected. 40 years later, Kahneman got a Nobel Prize for all that work on studying human judgment and advising what we can do to make our judgment better. It's when you write, when you describe your experiments, that's an important thing. You always describe your experiments in detail. Why do you have to do it? So that people who read your paper can make a judgment whether the results could be because of something that happened. If a subject didn't come, if a subject was late, if the in experiments in your lab, if the temperature was different or something, you know, describe it so that when you have your components for your concrete experiment. Sorry for that. Is there anybody working with concrete here in this room? No. So maybe it's a good subject. When you do experiments with your concrete, I would describe where you get the concrete from. We bought it from the BCM Białystok, right? This is Białystokska Centrala Materiałów Budowlanych, BCMB Białystok. Or we got it from three different places, different quantities, so that we spread the risk of the concrete being too similar. So, describe it in detail. And another thing that is very kind of robust that I've seen happen, when I taught this course and I had more time and I gave people as homework assignment to criticize somebody else's paper. I gave them a paper to criticize. Oh boy, the critique was really devastating for the authors. And they were asking questions, pointing out small things that, like, you know, the randomization might have not worked. There is this beautiful quote in the Bible, I think, Jesus, I think, says to some of the educated people, the Pharisees, he says, you jerks, you are seeing a splinter in the eye of your neighbor, of your bližni neighbor, and you don't see a big bulk in your own eye. And that quote is really, I think it's a very insightful description of the nature of human beings. When you think about this, it's much easier for us to see the fault of other people in those people than to see some problems in us. You see that in good relationships, like husband and wife, for example. Sometimes you see that your wife or your husband does something and you don't like it, and you don't realize that you do the same thing, right? It's that's why it's a very good idea to have other people around you in terms of personal life, personal behavior, other people around you. What do we say about men or women who are, let's say, in their 40s and they are unmarried? We say old spinster. Spinster is a funny English word. I think it comes from the spinning wheel, you know, like doing the thread, przędziarka, I would say. Old spinsters means the same as in Polish, stara panna, right? About a guy, we say stary kawaler. What do we mean by that? An old bachelor. We mean there's really something strange about them, right? Their habits, their behavior. Something funny about them. And that's a natural thing. People to grow, to develop normally, they need feedback. If you don't have feedback, you deteriorate. You need feedback. If you don't have friends, you don't have husband and wife who can tell you, hey, what did you do? Why did you do it, right? They essentially criticize you and influence you. If you don't have that person, you don't have a mirror through which you can see yourself, you deteriorate. The same happens to a scientist. Absolutely. If you are left alone and are allowed to do experiments and publish, you never get feedback, you never get reviews of your work, you will deteriorate, essentially. So feedback on your work, reviews, and talking to other people is absolutely crucial for the progress of science. Absolutely crucial. Without that, we would just do poor type of science. That deterioration happens everywhere. A dictator who is governing a country, when there is no criticism, look what happens. They are going to be essentially doing all kinds of funny things. In Christianity, there is something that prevents us. A religious society, which I believe Poland is, the society is still quite religious. Majority of the people are religious, and they are Christians. There's a beautiful invention in Christianity, and that is called confession. It's in, actually, it's only, I think, Catholic and Orthodox Church, because Protestant churches don't have it. They have a common confession. You know, you meet in a room, and they say, oh, we regret all our errors and sins. That's not enough. As a person, you go to the confessional, and it happens both in the Catholic and the Orthodox churches, and you say, I've done something bad. And a good friend of mine said once something that is also telling something about the nature of humans. He said, intelligent people don't sin. That's an ironic statement. An intelligent person who has stolen something, can explain to himself, well, given the circumstances, you know I took this, but, you know, given the circumstances, I don't think it was a theft. And then this intelligent person who never sins, humans are not rational, look at that, humans are rationalizing, right? We rationalize the things that we do. I go to confession, and then I say, well, you know, I took I kind of borrowed a pen from my work. And the priest says, well, tell me more about it. What do you mean borrowed? Have you returned it? That's exactly what we get from a good friend, from husband and wife, and in a situation like this. Or from a review as a scientist, right? That's precisely what we as humans need. If we don't get it, well, we never sin. You know, we kind of, we always can rationalize our bad behavior and the results. So sorry for being, for kind of finding the parallel in life, but I hope that will strengthen your appreciation for reviews, for exams, you know, for the doctoral dissertation defense and reviews of your dissertation. You need that. Because maybe you and your advisor is not enough. You need somebody else to look at it from outside. Societies that don't have those mechanisms, what do they have? People are not religious. People don't get married until they are 40. What do they have? Therapists, which are paid friends, essentially. You know, if you have friends, you can avoid that. You can save money, essentially. Or if you confess regularly, you can save money. You need that, and if you don't get it from anywhere else, you need a therapist. as a scientist, of course, in the professional life, you have the reviewers. So watch out your work, but also, most of all, watch out your work. You can, errors in other people's work you will see very easily as a reviewer. Let's see, how are we doing with time? We have half an hour today, roughly. We could start with learning and causal discovery, but I wonder if this is there's one thing I have that I kind of presented to my students in the past that has to do with this subject experimenter artifacts. And at the same time, it also shows us, makes us feel better, because it has to do with a famous, you could say, a scientist, Sigmund Freud, doing really sloppy work. Really sloppy work. I may have mentioned Freud already. Have I mentioned Freud here? I think I did mention it. I might have mentioned that experiment. So maybe it's not a good idea. I may have told you already that he was, when he was a young man, he was motivated to do. It's too little for that, for half an hour. So I'll just show you the interesting things. Cocaine. Cocaine was in that time, late 19th century. People brought it to Europe. Cocaine is made of coca leaves that are just a small plant living, growing in the Andes in South America. When I was traveling there in Peru, I wanted to try it, of course. I never tried any real drugs, but coca leaves have been natural for centuries, maybe thousands of years there. The local population used to chew them to essentially get some strength to be able to work longer, and it has also effect on the altitude. You get less of the altitude sickness. So I tried chewing coca leaves. That wasn't a success. It felt like chewing grass, essentially. So I chewed a little bit, and that was enough. Then I chewed. Then I had some coca tea, coca leaves, essentially, with water. You can see the cup here. You know, it's you also feel like drinking Japanese green tea, or having tea made of grass. Not very tasty, just the thing. And frankly, my feeling was that in order to feel any effect, I would need to drink a bucket of that. Because one cup, maybe it helped me with altitude sickness. I'm very sensitive to altitude, by the way. But I didn't feel it, really. So coca leaves have been there. But the purified form, cocaine, is essentially an extract. I don't know how they do it. Probably Europe has had the technology to extract cocaine from coca leaves. The local population of South America didn't have the technology. And I don't know what the technology is. You know, we can make instant coffee, probably pour water over coffee, make it very, very strong, maybe boil it, and then evaporate, make it evaporate, and whatever is left is the instant coffee. Maybe something like this. In any case, cocaine powder, which is essentially an extract of coca leaves, cocaine was added, by the way, to Coca-Cola at that time also. Not a lot, but just a little bit. Coca-Cola was, it was kind of nice. It made you more energetic. And currently, I think the secret recipe of Coca-Cola may still contain some coca leaves extract. So it's secret, we don't know. But the bitter taste may be actually from the coca leaves, maybe. In any case, late 19th century, it was available to over the counter. You could go to a drugstore and say, well, I want 10 decagrams of cocaine, right? Maybe it was expensive, that's why small quantities. You didn't need much to get a kick. And at that time, maybe I should come back to the slides. It was like a miracle thing. Late 19th century, it was somebody wrote a paper about it. Paolo Mattegazza wrote a paper about cocaine, and that was, medical benefits. That was an interesting thing. And Freud was a young man, very ambitious. He wanted to achieve success. Maybe he was your age. He wanted to achieve success. And there was a motivation. He wanted to get married to Marta Bernays, a young lady in Vienna. And they told him, her parents told him, there's a Jewish joke. No, Jewish jokes are very funny for us because the humor is very similar. There's a Jewish joke, a young man wants to marry a rabbi's wife and comes to the rabbi and says, I wanted to marry your daughter. So the rabbi asks, do you have any factories? No, I don't have factories. Do you have any stores? No, I don't have any stores. So what do you have? I have prospects. Perspectives. Perspective. If you have prospects, then you need binoculars. Not my daughter, right? Probably the parents of the young lady were tough on him, so he wanted to quickly become famous, make money. And he would try different things. One of the things he tried, eventually he became successful with psychoanalysis, which is also a very sloppy science. I may have mentioned that. Psychoanalysis is really very, very sloppy. Nobody serious, I think, would still attach any importance to it. In any case, cocaine, he thought, wow, this is an interesting thing. So he ordered some cocaine and started experimenting with this. He did many things. He noticed that his mood changed, he became more cheerful. He liked the cocaine a lot. And he started also prescribing cocaine. So he had patients, psychiatric patients. He thought, well, why don't I try to help them? He thought it was a magical drug. He was using it for many things, against depression, against indigestion, so physical problems with the stomach. He was using it to help people kick up addiction to morphine. I think it was morphine. So people who were addicted, he wanted to heal them with giving them cocaine. And of course, he made them addicted to cocaine over time. He didn't see it right away, but after a few years, he noticed. They credit him with around 50 or so cases in Vienna of drug addiction to cocaine. He became a public menace. Public menace is somebody who is really a problem to the society. And then he published, I think, four papers about cocaine. One of the papers was Über Coca, about cocaine. And the one that that this presentation is about is the influence of coca on the muscle strength and mood and other things. So in the experiments, he did them really very poorly. But that's about Freud. Freud was a very poor scientist, really very sloppy, poor scientist, with basic problems with his logical thinking. But he was a wonderful writer, a wonderful, wonderful writer. When you read him, wow, really wow. We have that with people sometimes. People, some people are wonderful speakers, very sloppy politicians, for example. And they think that when they speak very nicely, they can convince the society and they can justify their deeds. There's a quote from his writing. For example, he invented the following causal graph. He says, cocaine intake elevates your mood. It's the mood that makes the muscle stronger and makes you go longer and feel better, the mood. I wonder if it's true, and I wonder how he disentangled mood and physical strength. I don't know. Maybe there are two different things that are effects of cocaine. He had a device, they call it dynamometer. You could take a device like this and then you can measure how strong your grip is on that device. He was the only subject in the experiment. He knew what he wanted, right? He knew that he wanted to show that cocaine was a magical drug, very good. He was the only subject. So he, first of all, because he wanted to show, and he knew when he had a sniff of cocaine, I bet he probably had the motivation, unconscious motivation, to use more strength. And then he was reading the reading of the dynamometer. Even if he was precise, he had the motivation to make an error in one of the directions, not in the other. Here is a beautiful quote. When you read it, it's such a beautiful language. I realize that such observation has the shortcomings due to the person engaged in conducting them. He admits that he shouldn't be doing what he is doing. I admit it. I admit that claiming two sorts of objectivity for the same thing. Well, but still, I had to proceed in this manner for reasons beyond my control. I had no choice. And because none of the subjects at my disposal has such a regular reaction to cocaine. Right? So this is essentially the science of Freud, who was motivated. So, you know, it's similar to, I admit, I had no right to enter the TV station. I admit, I broke the Constitution, but still, I had no choice. Right? This is the same type of language that we see here. And, of course, readers of Freud buy it, you know, because it's such a beautiful writing. He wrote about the dreams, people's dreams, and the theory of dreams. What is the theory of dreams? Every time you dream something, there is an unconscious wish that is fulfilled by the dream. I think I mentioned that already in this class, right? Theory of dreams? Oh, a beautiful theory. You can still buy probably reprints of his book. Such a nice reading. Every dream has an unconscious motive for the dream. So if you dream, if you, for example, feel like having something sweet, you have a sweet tooth, they say it in English, then you go to sleep, and in your dream, you dream that you are eating a big cake, or you eat ice cream, such a nice sweet thing. That dream satisfied your desire. What can you say, then, about a dream that is unpleasant? Has anybody in this room had any unpleasant dreams? Like, as a student, I had many dreams occasionally I would have a dream that I come unprepared for an exam. Have you ever had a dream like this? I guess it would be difficult to find somebody who has never had a dream like this. When I became a professor, a faculty member, I started having dreams that I come to lectures unprepared, just as terrible. It turns out that soldiers who have been to wars often have dreams, terrible dreams, that they get wounded or they lose their hand once again. They kind of relive that. If you think about the theory of Freud, there is something wrong with those people. They must be masochists. right? Do you feel like masochists? I don't. My wife can testify I'm not a masochist. It was so funny because Grunbaum, the philosopher, spent many years studying Freud, and many people think that Freud is it's almost like religion, you know, like Marxist. Marxism is another example of that. The theories are not falsifiable. How can you falsify Freud's theory of dream? By the way, there was a case, at least two cases he described in his papers. There was once a young woman who hated her mother-in-law. She just couldn't stand her. She loved her husband, but she didn't like her mother-in-law. And she was also had mental problems. She was a patient of Freud. And one day, he describes in a paper, she came to me and says, I had a terrible dream, Dr. Freud. I dreamt that I was arranging my vacation with my husband, and I arranged it in such a way that I reserved a room next to ours in a hotel for my mother-in-law. This was a terrible dream. I woke up completely wet, sweated. Terrible dream. And Freud writes, again in his style, it seemed like a clear contradiction of my theory. It sounded like that. But no. Irma, he gave her name Irma, she was one of my smartest patients, most intelligent. And many times she argued with me about my theories. That dream, in fact, was satisfying her wish to prove me wrong. There's another case of a young attorney in Vienna who came to him, again a patient of his, who had a dream that he lost all his cases. The same explanation. He wanted to prove me wrong. Grunbaum wrote a paper, and I read the paper later after hearing him actually give a talk on that. He wrote it in a very funny way. Philosophers are really, and he is really very smart. Freud divides the population of the world, all the humans, into three groups. Normal people who have nice dreams, fulfilling their wishes, masochists, and the third group are people who wish Freud to be wrong. And that's why they have those dreams. And he says, well, as far as I know, I'm not a masochist. He didn't write it in the paper, but in the talk he said, and my wife is she here to testify this. And I had those dreams, counter-wish, I think he called it, counter-wish dreams. I had them long before I ever heard about Freud. It was kind of funny. So many people think Freud is just like a religion. You cannot falsify it, because that's a characteristic of a religion, right? In a religion, you cannot falsify anything. Something happens in the world, like, you know, there's an accident here. We can always say, God wanted it, right? Essentially, every statement, every theory we can explain, it's never possible to falsify that. In every religion, by the way. That's not typical for Christianity or any other religion. And the same with Marxism. Marxism has a theory, I think it is about class struggle. You've never had to learn it, you are too young, but as a young man in communist Poland, I had to learn the elements of Marxism. Class struggle. And in history, you can explain everything as a class struggle. There was a revolution in Egypt where the farmers revolted against the pharaoh. Class struggle. I'm sorry for that. Class struggle. First World War, class struggle. Everything is a class struggle. You cannot falsify it. Always can be explained. The same with Freud. Anything that happens with human behavior is essentially it is unconscious wishes, you know, unconscious things that are happening under the hood. Many theories. So he was terribly sloppy. For example, but Grunbaum was very interesting. He said, no, that's not true. Freud's theories are falsifiable. Unfortunately for him, for Freud, they don't come out good for Freud. Freud was preoccupied with sexuality. You may know the expressions like Oedipus complex. You've heard it. That's essentially men having a very special relationship with their mothers, like in the legend of in the myth about Oedipus. Penis envy. It has to be fair, right? Men and women. Women, apparently, according to Freud, envy men penises. Of course, that's a ridiculous idea, I think. Just ridiculous. An example of a theory Freud had, because how can you disprove it? I can say, well, you envy men penises. I don't. You do. You just don't admit it, right? How can you disprove it? There's no way you can disprove it. A theory by Freud, a theory that he had, the cause of schizophrenia, a terrible disease where you have multiple personalities, schizophrenia is caused by repressed homosexuality. So you are homosexual, you are repressing it, and that leads to schizophrenia. That's a theory. Grunbaum said, well, you can falsify it, of course. It's enough to find a homosexual who is standing on the corner of Wiejska and, what is that, the other street, Pogodna, shouting to the people, people, listen, I'm homosexual. Clearly, that person does not repress homosexuality. Yes? Clearly, there is no repression in there. And when that person is at the same time schizophrenic, well, the theory is wrong. Right? Because before that, of course, there's somebody schizophrenic. You are homosexual. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. You are repressing it. You see, that is very difficult to falsify that. Very difficult. in any case, coming back to here, the same kind of sloppy methodology, sloppy experimentation. There are many more examples of sloppiness in science, but Freud is a very, very, very nice subject of sloppiness, really. Here are the results of Freud's experiments. You see, he woke up, measured the strength, and then took a sniff of cocaine. He pretended to be very, very thorough in writing down exactly when he took a sniff of cocaine, the exact measurements, etc. But there's a fundamental problem with this. He was motivated to be stronger here. He was motivated to support the theory. So, sorry, but that is just sloppy science. He had actually two different devices, with one hand and with two hands. He did write down the exact times. I think that the explanation that he had no other subjects, that's a ridiculous explanation, the one that he gave here. Beyond his control, that's ridiculous. That's like in a movie, there's a movie, Dangerous Liaisons, with John Malkovich, where he explains a lady he dumps. It's all beyond my, it is beyond my control. Okay. Generic explanation that means nothing, really, nothing. Beyond my control. What does he mean? He could easily have found subjects who were willing to take cocaine and take part in the experiments. The funny thing is that these are just, details that are unnecessary. Problems with internal, external validity. He had his own experiences, of course, with cocaine. I may have mentioned that he wrote four papers, but they were not included in Freud's collected work. You know, that they sometimes publish collected work of somebody. Yes, just, to honor that person. His students have thoroughly excluded those papers from the collected works. You see science in action and bad things happening in science. The students of Freud were very motivated to, because he taught them to do psychoanalysis. He was teaching them, they did doctorates in his laboratory, they became psychiatrists using the method of psychoanalysis. They were very motivated to treat Freud as the big person and they were very motivated to hide any negative things about him. They did not include those papers. Only in 1980s, there was a guy who thought, well, why don't we publish those papers? He published those four papers in a book with a commentary, the Freud cocaine papers. Such is science, such can science be. Sometimes, I think it was another philosopher who wrote wasn't Kuhn, I think, the book is The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. When there is a change of paradigm in science, a very new thing, very often that new thing will not be accepted until the old guard dies. You know, the old people who have the previous paradigm literally die, retire or exit science, because they are very resistant to the new thing. That is also part of science, remember. With Freud, there may be still some people who are treating Freud seriously, but I don't think there is anything that really holds water in his work. The only thing may be, as I mentioned to you, he put a lot of kind of stress on sexuality with all these paradigms, you know, the penis envy, the Oedipus complex. There's an even funny quote from him. You know, the things have symbols. Anything that looks any close like this resembles a penis, a phallus. He said once, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, only a cigar. Just sometimes. So I think one thing that he may have been wrong is the importance that sexuality plays in humans. Maybe he was right about that. But all the other details, the theories, I don't think any of them are really... I'm surprised that Marx is still so popular, not in Poland, not in countries that actually had the experiences with communism, but it's still very popular in Western Europe and United States. Marx, I can't believe it. Even my sons. I had once an argument with my son. He told me I don't know anything about Marx, which was absolutely not true. I actually refreshed my memory. I knew a lot about Marx, much more than he did. They claim it's also science, which I don't think it is. I think it's just relative of religion. You cannot falsify those claims. You just cannot. And things that you can falsify usually they don't come out well for that thing. Freud applied it to anything, really. You see a whole list of things that he thought was very good. He experimented with it himself, and ended experimenting with cocaine. So it was a very short-lived adventure in 87 look what he writes again. Beautiful word, beautiful sentence. On more than one occasion, an aversion to the drug existed, which was sufficient for curtailing its use. So I'm stopping to use cocaine because of some silly reason, not because I made many people addicted to it and started feeling addicted myself. I'm stopping it for other reasons. That's not a very honest way of looking at things. 84, 87, you know, 3-4 years adventure of that. And you could say late 19th century, he didn't know better. That's not true. The idea of control and treatment was there already. The discovery of effects was there already. Clever Hans, people knew about what can happen. People knew that you cannot be a judge in your own case. You cannot be an experimenter and a subject. People knew that. So he was just very, very sloppy. These are details. My class, when I was teaching research design and then the problems in the laboratory, I sometimes would come with magician's equipment and I do some tricks, magician tricks. That was funny, usually. I still have that in my office. I should have brought it today. It's amazing that we can get fooled by magician tricks. Of course, there's no magic in that. But even I can do things that are, wow, how did he do it? You know, like mind reading and things with balls, with coins. Clark Glimmer, my colleague, a philosopher, I took his class on philosophy of science, kind of introductory class for undergraduate students. I wanted to get more systematic knowledge. He brought to class his neighbor, who was a magician, professional magician. The guy was doing amazing things, really amazing. He would take a hand of my colleague. She was also attending the class. She wasn't an undergraduate student. She was a doctoral student. And he put a coin in her hand and asked her to close her hand. So he put a coin, she closed the hand, and then he made the coin travel to the other hand. I don't know how he did it. I have no idea. Of course, it wasn't magic. But somehow, maybe when he touched her hand, he touched it in a way that, like in our eyes, she still had this sensation that there is a coin there, just the way he touched it. And he probably put it in the other hand gently, in such a way that the coin traveled. Amazing. It was really amazing. He showed us how he did some things, but the others are still a mystery. You know that there are some people who can make an airplane disappear. I don't know if it's live or just on cameras.
Camera tricks, right?
They are essentially playing on our expectations, and that tells us that our expectations are very important, our experiences and expectations in our observations. So the conclusion, we don't have really any time to start anything new. The conclusion is we should really watch ourselves very carefully. We should not trust ourselves. Distrusting ourselves in science, but I think also in personal life, is a good idea. Look at the current political climate in Poland or United States, the same thing. We still have a couple of minutes. So this incredible polarization. Think about this. You are smart people, well above the average of the society. And I bet, I'm willing to make a bet, that in this room there are representatives of both camps, of both polarization camps. What does it tell you? Well, it tells us facts. There's only one set of facts, right? We can have our opinions, and that's all right, we have our opinions, but we cannot have our own facts. Facts are only one thing. So if one smart person thinks differently than other smart person, I'm not pointing at anybody in particular, that means that the interpretation of facts is very different. That tells me that that we are flawed, very flawed. It's not only preferences, but also interpretations. Because preferences, of course, some of us are more progressive, so left-wing. Some of us are more conservative. That's all right. But given the facts, you would think, well, you see facts, you should think one way, just based on the facts. We don't do that. What that tells me that that we are, in our mental capabilities, we are flawed, because there is somewhere, correct interpretation of facts. I don't know where it is. There's a saying, I think it was one of those Catholic thinkers who said, the truth lies, sometimes we say the truth lies in the middle. Pravda leży po środku. He said, Pravda leży tam, gdzie leży. The truth is wherever it is. So it tells me that we are unable, as a group, individually, of course, individuals, we are unable to get to the truth, to the interpretation, to the theory, because there are many theories. I give kids, master students in this university, I give them an assignment to pick a statement by a politician and analyze it. Any politician, doesn't matter which one, and analyze it from the point of view of the theory that the politician is putting forward and the truth. And I'm seeing a lot of very interesting analysis, really very interesting. So, but anyway, that tells me that we are definitely imperfect as humans. And think about this, because as scientists, we need consensus, and we are trying to discover what is happening in the world, and we need to be very, very careful and very thorough. We cannot afford to be sloppy like we are in daily life, maybe. Anyway, thank you very much. That's it. Next week we will start with causal discovery. You'll see that it's quite cool, actually, quite cool methodology. Yeah. Thank you.